The following is an interview of Camilla Lowe, Professor Emeritus of Education of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, conducted by Mark H. Van Pelt on April 18, 1979. It is part of the School of Education's Oral History Project, sponsored by Dean John R. Palmer. Okay, perhaps you could start by discussing, you know, where you were born, that sort of basic kind of information before we head on to the other material.
All right. Well, I was born in Maplewood, New Jersey, and grew up there in a middle-class family. My parents were readers and thinkers, and they wanted their three children to have as good an education as they could get.
Mm-hmm.
I went to schools there
in
Maplewood.
What did your father do?
My father was a civil engineer working in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
He had the most to do with the building of the underground system of everything that was underground. He had something to do with. And then after my elementary and secondary school years, I went to Smith College in Massachusetts and received my AM degree there with a major in history and economics.
Mm-hmm.
I took one course in psychology, which counted toward my teacher's certificate, but it was mostly about rats and salivating dogs and things like that, so it really wasn't very helpful. And graduated in 1922 and immediately got a teaching post with a limited teacher's certificate in South Orange High School, New Jersey, a very excellent school. I started there in 1922 and taught history, but it was at the very beginning of the guidance movement, and that school really pioneered. I was involved immediately in the development of a cumulative record, which were very scarce in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just about to set up a full guidance program system-wide. Elementary and secondary education. I think I was the luckiest young teacher you can imagine, because I had a principal, Dr. John Bosshart, who later was quite well known both in the state and I think in a wider audience, certainly in the East. And he had a very great sense of the importance of individual differences in youngsters and the kinds of developmental problems that adolescents have.
Mm-hmm.
And that every classroom teacher had to become sensitized to the youngsters that he or she was teaching, and had to empathize and understand what an important role the family played in the situation, all of those things which are basic to the whole guidance concept. So I got from him very early in the game. Well, that started me off on my 13 years I was with that school system.
Mm-hmm.
And I hadn't been there for more than a year when the Board of Education sent three people, paid the expenses of three people to go to the Harvard Summer School for courses and guidance.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very interesting experience for me. I came back and became what was then known as a class guide. It was really a counselor. And we had in that school eventually four class guides, each I guess it was three. It was a senior high school. Three class guides, and there were about 1,000 students in the school. We taught one class apiece, and all the rest of the time we had for guidance. Now, knowing the present day situation, mm-hmm. and how many hundreds of and even more people one poor counselor has, that was a pretty ideal situation. So that started me off in my field.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took a year's leave of absence to get my master's degree. I think it was in 1925, and to finish and to get take a couple of courses I needed to get a teacher's certificate. And I went to the University of Michigan for that. I majored. I got my degree in history, American history. And I went there because they had such marvelous primary source material on the revolutionary period, and that's what I did my master's thesis on, and carried these other courses in sociology and psychology. I forget what else. I think measurement, in order to get my teacher's certificate. In the years that I spent in South Orange High School, one of my best friends and colleagues was Dr. Mildred Fisher. She was the one who, in the guidance area, set up the whole child study program. And later on, she was a professor in the summer school here for quite a number of summers, and she taught courses in guidance. I left high school teaching in about 1935 and went to Stanford University for my doctor's degree. There, my major was in sociology and the minor was in sociology. My major was in guidance and curriculum combined. And while I was there, My major professor did a great deal for me, Dr. Harold Hand. He himself was a very fine individual and really helped me a great deal, particularly in my research. He was always there and always had good ideas. You know, I could always get to him, and I think that this is a very, very helpful thing. I know that some other graduate students don't have as fine a relationship and as helpful a relationship with their major professor. So I spent 5 years there, or 4 years, I guess. I left in 39. And while I was taking courses, I was also dean of girls at Redwood City High School. And there I had a most happy experience, very different from the one that I'd had in Maplewood, which in South Orange, which was also happy. But there in South Orange, I had superior students always. And in Redwood City, it was a very different situation. This was during the period of the Okies,
mm-hmm.
and there was much coming and going, itinerant laborers' families moving from one place to another. And it was also in the depth of the Depression, and there were many youngsters in my classes who didn't have any sense of self-esteem. Their fathers were out of work, or they were working for WPA. There was a great deal of poverty, as well as at the upper end, there were some very, very intelligent and people who were at a higher intellectual level. It was during the period when they were trying out in California block teaching, and during the time that I was there, I taught one block, as well as being a dean of girls. And that was a combination of history and English. It was a wonderful way to teach, because you could you had plenty of time to integrate the two subject matter areas. And also these blocks were placed so that they were either at the beginning of the day with an opportunity for a field trip before school, or field trip in the middle of the day, or at the end of the day. We had a great deal of going out in the community and tying up the community living with what we were teaching in class. So that experience was good. And then during the summers, I taught guidance courses at the university, at Stanford.
Let me ask a couple of questions. One, you mentioned that you were a class guide.
Yes.
When you were at mm-hmm. New Jersey in the 20s. The profession of guidance was not exactly very well developed at that point, was it?
Well, it was developed as well as it is in many places today, really.
Can you elaborate what you mean by
that? Well, we had conferences mm-hmm. with all of our students. A guide was a counselor. I mean, it was a counselor, but a general counselor. Mm-hmm. We didn't have, our guidance was done primarily with teachers, because we had a very great respect for the role of the teacher in guidance. And our administrator felt this way too. That is, he felt, and we felt too, that we would like to work ourselves out of the job if we could do enough for the teachers so that they could engage in what was known as developmental guidance, if they were alert to the kinds of problems that the normal adolescent has in growing up. Mm-hmm. And the way in which he showed his disturbances and his worries in the classroom, and what the teacher could do by just being aware of the individual as a human being, and could adjust the methods of his teaching to what the individual youngster really needed. So I think that we really did a pretty good job here. And then, of course, we had, for problem cases, of course, we had individual guidance with youngsters. And we kept very excellent records. And this was a time when we were asking teachers to write summaries. These would be, in other words, our records were descriptive. And we got them from the teachers, as well as our own descriptive descriptions of youngsters and the problems that they had, and the ways in which we were trying to help them. So from that point of view, I think we really were quite far along, even though it was initiated that early.
In other words, though, you didn't emphasize things like
Measurement
and
well, it was at the point where
guiding people in the classwork and that sort of thing. Like guiding people into vocational courses or
as far as measurement is concerned, we did have a program for measurement, but it was mostly group tests. If individual tests were needed, we had a child study department which took care of that, and that department was for the whole system, and it wasn't housed in our building, but it was available to us. So that we did have, and I don't think, though, that we ever put too much emphasis on just scores. Because I think that the whole philosophy of the school was such that we recognized that this was a very dangerous thing to do. As far as vocational guidance was concerned, in that school, the bulk of our students went to colleges. And we did a great deal of college guidance. helping youngsters select colleges, and of course in planning their programs to meet their goals, their special academic goals, and in finding colleges that were finding a college for each one that was appropriate. So that we did.
Can you contrast that to what it was like being dean of girls in Redwood City?
Well, yes, I can. As dean of girls, I had many, many problems. These girls came from, some of them from foster homes. Some of them had been in deep trouble. They were delinquent, really delinquent girls, some of them. There was a great deal of truancy, and this was one of the areas in which I was very much interested, because it was so amusing to me to have these girls come in to me and who had been truant, and with the stock stories, you know, that their grandmother had died, and or their mother was having a baby or something like this, and they had to stay home. I was perfectly aware that most of these stories were just, had nothing whatsoever to do with the facts. Mm-hmm. But I made up my mind that I would start accepting them. And if they'd had a sorrow in the family, why, I was sympathetic. And I tried to respond as if it was all true. Mm-hmm. And sent them on their way and hoped that things would work out. And if they needed any help from me, why, that I would love to do anything I could to help with the family. Mm-hmm. Then after that had gone on for not too long, a girl came in and gave me the same cock and bull story for something or other. And I listened and smiled, and I said, "Now what really happened?" Mm-hmm. And she said, "Well, I tell you, Miss Lowe, I had to get my hair done because I was invited to a party tonight and I didn't know when I could do it because I work in the afternoon, and there was absolutely no time I could go except during school." I said, "Well, that sounds very sensible. Why didn't you come in and tell me?" "I would have made the arrangements." "You would?" she said. And I said, "Certainly, I think that that's I can see your predicament." Mm-hmm. "And certainly we could have worked it out. You must have had one period that was free, and we could have worked the thing out. So try me." Well, that happened two or three times. And then one day, the whole group of persistent truancy girls came in, and I said, "My, I haven't seen you." Truancy had dropped off quite a bit. I said, "I haven't seen you girls for a long time," and they all giggled. And I said, "How come?" They said, "Well, we've got a no cut club that we belong to." So that ended that. Well, anyway, it was very different.
Did your coursework that you'd had so far, you know, and guidance and so on, do you think it really prepared you for this sort of experience very well? Did you find that you utilized your training to that point?
Well,
or was it more of your own experience?
I think I had utilized my experience. Because, you see, I'd already had 13 years of experience as a guidance counselor. So it was my experience more than my coursework. Mm-hmm.
Did you find, even when you first started?
I think it was my own feeling for these kids. Mm-hmm. I really do. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't have any preparation for that. After I went to Harvard, why, I knew a little bit more. I knew something about measurement and a few things like that, but I really think that the counseling sort of came naturally to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. After you were at Stanford, then, you got your degree, and
right.
Then you came, shortly thereafter, you came to Wisconsin.
Right.
How is it that you got to come to Wisconsin, or chose Wisconsin?
Well, when I was getting my doctor's degree, one of the other students was, what's his name? Oh, can't remember. Oh, Mackenzie. Gordon Mackenzie. And, of course, he came before me, and he was the principal of Wisconsin High School. Mm-hmm. And he was the one who hired me to come to teach in Wisconsin High School.
Okay. Okay.
So that was that. And I really did enjoy the year or two that I spent there mm-hmm. with him. I thought he was a very good principal. And I also enjoyed my teaching. I taught history there. But, of course, the work that I did in the supervision of student teachers was done because of my my friend Gladys Borchers. I had never met Gladys Borchers before, but she really took me under her wing.
Mm-hmm.
And she had too much of too big a job anyway, and she asked me if I would be willing to supervise her students out in the field. So that was my first knowledge of the schools, the public schools, and in the area. Now, I'm not sure. Some of those at that time, I think, were out of the area. I'm not sure how many of those student teachers were within the city limits mm-hmm. at that time. But at any rate, I got out and around, and I had a very, very good experience in supervising speech students. But there was a tremendous altercation at that point between Gladys, not between the individuals, but the philosophy that Gladys held, that she considered me qualified to be a general supervisor. And the others who said that there was no such thing as a general supervisor of student teaching, that nobody could supervise a teacher unless he were a member of the methods department and understood the from A to Z the subject that the student was expected to teach.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that conflict.
That was the conflict between the other chairman of the various departments
right.
within Wisconsin High School.
Who were doing the supervision.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Were the sorts of things that you were considered to do or for your evaluations of teachers and things of that sort, are they basically the same things that are done today, or do you feel that that's
well,
changed a little bit?
Well, I don't know. I just don't know the answer to that question.
Well, or at least at the time when you retired, Were people being
yeah.
evaluated in the same with the same criteria, or were,
well,
you
see,
look
after
at students
that,
a little differently then?
After that, I really never did supervise student teaching.
Uh-huh.
So that was just sort of a short term.
Oh, okay.
Of course, my philosophy is that there's a great deal that a general supervisor can do for beginning teachers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not really trying to find out whether she knows anything or not. What you're trying to find out is whether she knows how to get across what she knows to these youngsters and the kind of climate that's in the classroom and how she can make it better and whether she is at ease, what her personality traits are that would be helpful in the situation or harmful. How she handles disciplinary problems, many of those things, which of course wouldn't make much difference what subject she taught.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perhaps you can compare generally what Stanford as to Wisconsin was like. You know, you were there close.
All
to
right, I'll try to do that. I had a very fine experience at Stanford. But I realized when I came to Wisconsin that Wisconsin was really serving the people of the state in the way that Stanford could never serve the people. I think there's a great difference between a state university and a private college such as Stanford was. Stanford was it cost a great deal of money to go to Stanford, and the early days when I was here, that wasn't the case at the University of Wisconsin. And the makeup of the classes I found extremely stimulating and interesting in Wisconsin, because we had so many people from the farm and people who came from good solid families but had very little money to spend. And some of these boys and girls that were in my classes had some rough edges as far as their social behavior was concerned. Mm-hmm. They didn't know enough, some of them, to take off their caps when they came into the classroom, a few things of that kind. But they were good, solid citizens, and I really had a great feeling of affection for my students, and I was glad, always glad, to be a part of the University of Wisconsin. I also felt that we made a special effort in the School of Education, and I think this is true all over the university, to attract foreign students and Negro students, and to really be helpful, to try to help them with the problems that they faced in trying to become oriented to our way of doing things. And that appealed to me very much indeed.
What about in terms of the nature of the training and education? Were Stanford and Wisconsin quite different there as well?
Well, I didn't have anything to do with the undergrad, and in fact, I don't even know whether they had an
Stanford
undergraduate.
Stanford is graduate, that's what I'm referring to.
Oh, the graduate program.
Right.
I see. Well, the graduate program at Stanford, I think, was a very much smaller program, mm-hmm. really, than at the university, at least at the time that I was there.
Were they philosophically compatible?
They were philosophically compatible, I would say. Mm-hmm. Probably, maybe more so even than Wisconsin. I'm not sure about that. But it was a small group. They had a very fine sociologist, and their administrator was strong, Dr. Kiefover. It was a good department, but I didn't feel it was as large a department, or had as important. As important a department in the whole university as our department was in this university.
Okay.
All right. Well, when I went up on the hill, one of the things that I had to get adjusted to was the fact that I was the first woman in the Department of Education. And I was very, very much pleased with the way in which I was greeted and in the development of the friendships, how quickly I developed friendships with most of the people on the staff. It was a small staff.
Mm-hmm.
And a very, very nice men. I enjoyed working with them, and I had great respect for them. John Guy was a little bombastic, but underneath John Guy and I, after the first few times that we differed in our opinions, we worked out a relationship that was really very pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
So that.
Well, after you got settled down not too long into the department,
World War II began, and I'm sure must have had a considerable impact on the school. Perhaps you can speak to that a little bit.
Yes, it certainly did. For one thing, John Rothney left, which meant that I took over as much of his work as I could. And of course, the whole nature of the school was different. There were very, very few men there. And so that it was quite a different proposition to teach just women. The staff didn't really have enough to do. And therefore, one of the things that we did was to set up a research project which had to do with the follow-up of student teachers in the field. Mm-hmm. And I think that it was Dr. Barr who really got that going, and we had a committee and developed a plan for it. And my role was to take a year, I think I was out a year, it may have been a semester, to follow up the first year of student teaching, follow up the teachers now that had had 1 year of student teaching. And that was an eye-opener to me, particularly because I wasn't very familiar with the state. And I went here, there, and everywhere and became fascinated with the little communities of German in one place and Welsh in another place and Norwegians in another section, so that I had a very happy time doing that personally, but I also got acquainted with some very tiny schools in the northern part of the state. One school that I remember, I can't remember the name of it, but it was up in the Lake District somewhere, and it was so remote that they had a teacherage, and I'd never heard of that before. All the teachers stayed in this one building,
uh-huh.
and were on the spot so that they could come to school and teach the next day. That was a good experience. I kept good records of the teachers that I was following up, and I felt as though by and large they were doing a remarkably good job. These teachers were in the fields of home economics and speech and English and history. Every field, I think, was represented in the teachers that I visited. And by and large, I found that they had enthusiasm and that they were creative in their approach. And of course, it wasn't altogether that, but really, it was quite a feather in the cap of the department, I thought, the way these women were handling themselves. Mm-hmm. There were no men on the job at that time. Yeah. They'd left.
You mentioned the diversity of communities that they were working in. How did they adapt themselves to their communities, or did many of them have come from those communities to begin with?
Well, some of them had come from the communities to begin with, and they had no trouble. And I really didn't see too much evidence, as I look back on it now, of a lack of adjustability as far as that was concerned. They certainly, the students were certainly different, one group from another in their background, but that didn't seem to be a big problem as I remember it.
Okay. What else? Well, during the war, I know, for instance, you acquired several women on your faculty, or a few more women on the faculty, I believe, than you had before. Is that correct? Like Sarah Rue, perhaps, and a few others?
Well, I don't know. I really don't remember whether we acquired anybody during that period.
Mm-hmm.
We were overstaffed.
What other things were done to take up your time, so to speak.
Well, I think that I did teaching, of course, mm-hmm. and I had more teaching in the field of guidance than I would have had if Rodney had been there. Mm-hmm. So I had plenty to do after that first semester in teaching my courses. And I taught, I always taught, of course, this undergraduate course in Education 73. Mm-hmm. And that went on with all the women. So we just didn't have quite as many sections. And I don't know what the men were doing at that time. I don't know the way in which they filled up the time that they normally would have had more sections of teaching. Mm-hmm. But as far as I was concerned, I think I was rather in the position of having enough to do because of Rothney's absence.
Did you get a sense that the war changed, or during the war years, there was any sort of change in the orientation or emphasis or the way that students came to education than they had in your experience before that? I know it wasn't.
No, but I had a great sense of a change after the men came back.
Really?
Yes. I think that the very best classes I ever had in Education 73 were these classes that when the men came back in hordes with a purpose mm-hmm. and with enthusiasm. They knew what they were about. And I had had men in my classes before, but it was entirely different. These men were more mature, and some of them were married. And I remember that in this course, The Child, His Nature, and His Needs, which was Education 73, we had quite a number of married men, and some of them had children. I remember one young man who had just had a child. His wife had had a child, and he offered to bring it to class. So he came with this little babe in arms, and the proudest man you could ever see, and said, "Now I'm going up and down the aisle so that all of you men and women can see my baby." And it was really terribly funny. But, you know, the very fact that they were in the process of having children or of certainly were married, some of them, and the fact that they had a vocational goal in mind, it meant that the work that they were doing was very, very superior. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this enthusiasm was caught by the girls. And so the whole situation, I thought, was very, very good after the men came back.
Are you saying that they were not simply more interested in getting through their work, but in terms of evaluating what they were being taught?
That's right, and taking initiative. And, of course, during these years, we had the laboratory program, which was a very, very important aspect of Education 73. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps that you might like to have me go into a little bit. But I think our school was pretty much a pioneer in pre-student teaching work in the field for our students, undergraduate students.
You go ahead.
All right. I was in charge of that whole program, mm-hmm. and it involved sending a semester, at least one semester, of work in the community for every student in Education 73. And this was tied in, of course, with their what they were learning about a child study. Instead of putting them in schools, they were assigned to community activities, to Girl Scouts, Boy Scouts, neighborhood house, playgrounds, all kinds of community activities that would bring them into contact with young children. And whether they were going into secondary education or primary or elementary education, we felt that they could get a great deal out of participating with children and learning how to organize them into their game groups and how to react to their hurts and how to handle the disciplinary problems that were involved here. One of the things that everyone did was to write a case history of one of these children. So they had the opportunity to put into practice and to actually utilize all of the techniques of child study that they were learning in Education 73. Mm-hmm. And they liked this part of the course very much. They were very enthusiastic. I think it put spice into the whole program, and by doing so, they were able to really see what it meant to study a child. And they used every technique they could think of, and particularly observation. They learned how to be good observers of individual differences in children.
When you say observers, did you try to teach them particular theories of development or that sort of thing that helped guide their observation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is what Education 73 was really all about. It was a developmental patterns, you know, and what could be expected, mm-hmm. norms within limits, what you could expect of children at different age ranges, and how to observe, mm-hmm. what sort of reactions would tell you, give you information about a child.
Mm-hmm. I presume that although there must have been competing theories at that time in terms of child development, what theories were?
I don't know what the competing theories were. What do you look at as competing theories?
Well, for instance, I mean, somebody might look at it in a Freudian or, you know,
I see what you mean. Well, we didn't get into they hadn't gotten that far ahead to know anything about competing theories. This was a very practical course.
Okay.
And it was based upon the assumption that the social, emotional, intellectual, physical aspects of the child's growth impinged on each other, that you had to know about all of them, mm-hmm. and that there were various ways in which you could observe how the child was adjusting socially, what his emotional hang-ups might be, but it was on a very elementary level.
Did you work with Kai Jensen in this?
Yes, very closely. Kai, I think it was Kai and I that felt that it would be a very good idea to have some kind of a laboratory manual that could be given to students. And I wrote that manual, and I had it published, and everybody in education, every student in Education 73 bought one of those manuals. And that had a lot of examples, illustrations, and thumbnail sketches of what children are, little studies of children, you know, mm-hmm. so that they could have some sort of idea of what we hope they would get out of an experience like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Kai was very, very well pleased with this. And he and I really worked extremely well together on this program. And then Rothney, of course, he came back and came in a little bit later on it, and he was very enthusiastic. And he was the one who hoped it could develop and and be a permanent part of the program. But like so many other things, you know, when the two people who are most enthusiastic about it leave, then the thing dies, which is really very unfortunate from our point of view.
Mm-hmm. The things that you learned in working this program, were they of primary use to you when you then went on later to this 1950 National Conference on laboratory teaching and that sort of thing?
Yes, very. Of course, all of the time I had been a member of the National Association of Student Teachers, and also a member of the supervision, and the Association of Supervisors of Teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what those exactly what those national organizations were like, but I was active in both of them, and I was president of the for two terms during the war of the National Association of Student Teaching. I think it was called at that time. I think it's called something different now, and it was because of my activity there that I became involved in quite a number of workshops. I was the leader of a number of workshops that were held. Well, one was held in, I think it was West Virginia. And then I was involved in one in Oklahoma and various places.
As you shared your experiences on this line with other people from around the country, did you find that they were doing things very similar to you, or that or Wisconsin was doing something different in some respects than they were? Or
well, it was the period during which they had come to the conclusion that experience in the classroom was not enough, student teaching in the classroom, that it should be preceded by other experiences with young people. And while I think that you can say that the programs for this pre-student teaching were all worked out within that span of years, you know, everybody got very much interested in laboratory experiences. But most of them were with teachers who were training to be elementary school teachers. And I think we were rather unique to have this kind of program for secondary school teachers at that time. All right.
Now, in between all these other activities, particularly after the war, you were still very involved, I presume, with Mr. Othney and so on, with counseling, or with guidance and personnel, I guess, as it's put.
Right.
You also mentioned that there seems to be a bit of a contrast between your experiences with the summer school people and with your academic year people in that regard. Could you talk to that a little bit?
Well, I always got a great deal of pleasure out of teaching in the graduate school, whether it was during the year or in the summer. And I was particularly interested in the courses that I was teaching in guidance to people outside the School of Education. For example, there were nurses from the School of Nursing, and there were, in the later years, There were men from the College of Engineering who felt that this aspect of it was important to them. And this interested me very much, the personnel aspect and how to get along with the people that they were working with. That was really their point. Well, when I got students who represented not only those who were going out for the first time as grad students into teaching, but also nurses and engineering students, and I don't know, recreation people and so on. That I thought was extremely interesting to me. And I really think that I wouldn't have been interested if they hadn't been interested.
Mm-hmm.
So that we had some very lively classes. And we did quite a few unusual things in those classes. We used a lot of aids of various kinds, mm-hmm. such as role-playing and films of various kinds. And there, I found that the films really helped them greatly in this whole area of child study. And they were very, very much interested in them.
What sort of film would this be?
I can remember one film. For instance, it was called Angry Boy.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a method. It showed the in story form the way you handle an angry boy and the background from which this angry boy came.
Mm-hmm.
It was an excellent film, and there were others that I can't remember the names of them, but they really fit in very well indeed. So that was good. But in contrasting my classes during the year with those that I had in summer school and those that I had in extension courses at night,
mm-hmm.
I would say that the students that I had in the latter two courses were very serious about everything. They knew what they needed to learn. They were in the field. They were teachers. They had to go back every day and try to put into practice what they had learned in the class the night before. This is the extension class.
Mm-hmm.
And this, of course, gave me a great deal of pleasure to think that they found that they could use what they were getting from the classes. In the summer school, of course, it was the same thing. They were working up to what they were going to do the next fall when they got back. And I think that the fact that there were so many classroom teachers who were in these courses in the summer taking guidance had a tremendous effect on the teachers' own methods of teaching. I think they changed tremendously, because they were aware, much more aware, of how important it was to study these children and to get in touch with their home backgrounds. And we made quite a point of the importance of the home, and some of them took as their special project studying homes of their students and actually learning where the student came from, going, visiting students'
mm-hmm.
homes,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. And this was all, I felt, a very good thing for them, and something that made teaching much, much more interesting to them.
Do you think, is that some sort of a new development, that is the developing the idea that you ought to visit children's homes and that sort of thing? Is that...
Well, I don't think it's a new idea, and I must say that I don't think you can always do this kind of thing because of the very heaviness of the job mm-hmm. that you're carrying. But when you realize that, when a teacher realizes that the answer to so many of the problems that she is facing in the classroom is in the home, why, if she's got a bad problem, she probably will find some way of developing a relationship with the parents.
Well, I guess what I was asking would be, for instance, during the time when you were in high school and teaching there and working in high school, were the attitude of the teachers somewhat different about that, or had they been trained to
approach
the problem differently?
No, they had not been trained to go to the homes, and I don't think they had gone.
Mm-hmm. So that was...
This was new from the standpoint of my own childhood
uh-huh.
and school experience, certainly.
Okay, so that...
Right.
Okay, that's important.
Right.
Another thing that occurred to me was that, as you mentioned, a lot of other different departments had an interest in what you were doing and what you had to offer. but I presume that some other place in the university, perhaps the business school, for instance, must have had their own people who were doing some work with guidance or personnel work and that sort of thing.
Well, I think probably the School of Business did. I'm not sure about that, though.
Okay.
Of course, they had their own counselors, I believe, mm-hmm. for students. You see, and this leads me to say that anybody who's in the field of teaching, counseling, and guidance uses many, many, many hours in guiding and counseling, mm-hmm. which is not a part of the job, but is a very satisfying aspect of the experience. So, and one thing in particular, I think that people who are in the field of guidance have a tendency to recognize that not only children in secondary school need guidance, but also college students and graduate students mm-hmm. and PhD candidates. You know, they all have their problems, mm-hmm. and sometimes they just pile up. And they have to have someone that they can come to whom they think understands what this is all about. And I found that there were hours of Rothney, too. And I'm sure that Mr. Edgerton had the same. All of us had many people coming in after school, all hours, calling us for personal help. Mm-hmm. So this is really a part of the job. It has to be.
Yeah. What I was getting at was that was your course that you were teaching and the studies that you taught fairly unique then to the campus at the time that you were working at it, or did you have interaction with other people?
I didn't have interaction with other people, uh-huh. Except for those for nursing and engineering.
Mm-hmm. And those were students who came to your courses, not the faculty in the schools contacting you to
take
them.
That's right.
Okay.
Of course, I had a contact in the same way with music students and uh-huh. and from all other parts of the college, the school.
Now, okay. Also, it would be nice if you could contrast a little bit the nature of the program as you ran it and Mr. Rothney had it in terms of your philosophy about it, in contrast to your impression now of what the program is as it is today.
Well, I think it was when we had it, Mr. Rothney and I, that we were very, very much concerned with the important role that the teacher played in the field of guidance. And we felt that it was the person who had the daily contact with children who knew the most about him, mm-hmm. provided that person, the teacher, had enough background to child study and in the field of guidance to really do some guidance in her classroom. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, it seems to me that it was all a great deal simpler when Mr. Rothney and I were teaching our guidance courses. We were trying to help these prospective teachers who might never become guidance counselors play a role in guidance when they were in the classroom. That was one thing. And we were trying to help the prospective guidance counselor appreciate that it was not enough to just counsel youngsters one by one in an office with the door closed. Mm-hmm. That it was very important to have a larger role in the school, to have many contacts with teachers and to be helpful to teachers in the developmental aspects of this whole guidance role. And where we had a special problem, which of course
All right.
Where we had a special problem that had to be dealt with on a one-to-one basis, it was very important to follow up that with the teacher. Mm-hmm. And to remain in close touch with what was going on in the classroom and what the teacher's problems were in handling these youngsters. And that leads me to say that Rothney and I always felt as though a guidance counselor should have had a background of classroom teaching. I think that it's probably quite different today. Mm-hmm. And I believe that there's a loss here in not having such a background. I think that I have noticed it in recent years in the schools that I've just visited that many times there is not a very good feeling between teachers and the counselor. Mm-hmm. The counselor is earning a higher salary. He seems to have more prestige. He sometimes has at least a master's degree or a doctor's degree. And this is very unfortunate to my way of thinking. Mm-hmm. And I think part of that comes from the fact that it is hard, that counselors really don't understand the problems of teachers many times. Mm-hmm. And if they had had that experience, of course, I think that they could probably do a better job in relationships, in relating to teachers, and in really helping teachers with their problems as they see them in the classroom.
Would it be fair to say that most of the people who took your coursework were either teachers or prospective counselors who then worked mainly in the public schools?
I think so. Yes. You mean instead of in colleges?
Right, or in various other places.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's true. I can see how this would be somewhat different if you were a counselor on the college level. Mm-hmm. Although I think there too, it wouldn't be a bad idea to have been a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, in terms of, well, during the time that you were here working in this field, did you feel that you ever made any drastic or at least significant changes in the emphasis you put into your own graduate teaching in this area from what you had originally started as? Incorporate new areas of research or new theoretic concepts?
I don't think any drastic things. I do think that the work that I did in the, maybe I should talk about the work I did in the State Department of Public Instruction.
Okay.
This was in connection with the doctoral degree that I got at Stanford too. I have always felt that there's a close connection between guidance and curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
And these things that we used to call concomitant learnings, you know, come into play here. That while you're teaching a subject matter, some kind of help and guidance is going on at the same time, and you are in the process of attempting to help boys and girls adjust. So that close connection between guidance and curriculum led me to become interested in curriculum in the public schools of the state and out of the state too. And I was became the chairman of a committee on curriculum development for the State Department. And this proved to be a very enlightening, stimulating to my own thinking.
Mm-hmm.
In the course of the work of that committee, we got out four rather elaborate pamphlets. One which it started with a guide to the curriculum on the kindergarten level.
Mm-hmm.
And the next one was on the elementary level, and we had one on the junior high level and one on the senior high level. I wrote completely the one on the other ones on the junior and senior high levels. And this was not an attempt to try to put down in black and white content mm-hmm. by any means, but it was taking the broad areas of adjustment to life that the child goes through, you know, social adjustment, vocational adjustment, physical well-being, and all of these large areas of adjustment, and analyzing them with reference to teaching goals, to the kinds of things that we could help children understand and gain in the process of teaching them English, along with teaching them English and arithmetic and all the other things. So now I do think that had a great effect on the way in which I approached my guidance courses. It couldn't help but have.
Mm-hmm. Just for the record,
yeah.
The we on this committee.
Yes.
Who are?
Yes, and you asked me who, and again, these names escape me. It's very difficult.
No, but I mean from what kind of institutions?
Well, we had the head of the teachers, of the supervisor of teachers in the Janesville Public Schools mm-hmm. on that committee, and we had similar people. Some were classroom teachers from a variety of schools in the state mm-hmm. working on the committee.
Okay. And the committee, you were invited to be a part of it by the Department of Public Instruction.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
I would like to say this, that the tome, it was really a thick book that this developed into on the secondary school level, mm-hmm. At senior high school level, was considered so important at the University of Illinois that they asked if they could, it was really Harold Hand, Dr. Harold Hand, who asked permission to run off 1,000 copies for distribution in this among their staff and also in the schools in Illinois. Mm-hmm. So it was used in two states.
When you, along with this influence on the mm-hmm. nature of the teaching, during the latter 50s and the middle 50s, mm-hmm. I believe that other people came into the Department of Education who were also interested in counseling and personnel work and that sort of thing, like Mr. Farwell, for instance.
That's right.
For instance, Mr. Farwell is one I know of specifically, but did these people have an influence on the nature of your program?
I think they didn't have an influence so much on my teaching. I don't think they mm-hmm. did have, but I do think that as different people came into the department and it was enlarged, mm-hmm. we had different points of view
mm-hmm.
and different priorities. So from that angle, I think it enriched the department. Mm-hmm. I think that today, of course, it is a much larger department than it ever was before, and it has become one of the areas of professionalism to the extent that it never did before.
Mm-hmm. When, for instance, a person like Mr. Farwell or other person who would be in guidance and personnel, were you and Mr. Rothney especially consulted concerning their appointment or... How is that conducted?
Well, that I don't know. I was never consulted.
Mm-hmm.
I know. And, of course, we didn't have, we really didn't have get-togethers either that I can think of very often of the people who were teaching courses and guidance.
Mm-hmm.
We knew each other well. But Mr. Edgerton and Rothney and I were working hand and foot together, but there was no organization to it,
uh-huh.
you know.
Uh-huh.
And it was only after I left that they had a department of their own.
Okay. In that case, I guess what I would ask is, how did you handle students who were interested in a master's degree and a concentration in counseling? How would that be handled amongst those of you who were interested in that? Or did you primarily take care of that yourself?
I think it was just handled in the hall.
Uh-huh.
It's about the way it was very, in those days, it was very simple.
Okay. Well, perhaps speaking to students a little bit, maybe that we can switch to that next. Of course, you were very involved with handling of graduate students, particularly during the 50s. You remember the graduate examination committee and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me a little bit about how that committee worked? And
we had regular meetings. And we took a look at the candidates that were going to take the, we were in charge of the exams.
Mm-hmm.
These were the preliminaries, you see, the
right.
The preliminary exams. And we worked out in general scheme what kinds of questions we would ask. And during the years that I was chairman, the way it worked was that I drew up the exam and then submitted it to their, for them to react to.
Mm-hmm.
And it was generally, acceptable. And then those exams were given and they were graded, read and graded by the committee,
mm-hmm.
By individuals in the committee. And then, of course, we had to have meetings to discuss when there was someone who definitely needed to have somebody, when a candidate needed, or the exam needed to be read by more than one person.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of them were read by more than one person, as I remember it.
In other words, for any graduate student in the Department of Education.
Yeah.
Your committee made up the examinations for them.
That's right. These are master's exams, too.
Uh-huh. It was possible, then, for, say, the student's major professor not to be involved in the making up of his exam or her exam.
Yes, this is right. Now, again, say there.
Well, you were saying about the nature of the examination itself.
Yes.
And that period was not oriented towards
to fields. Yeah, that's right.
It was oriented towards what?
Well, it was oriented toward large problem areas,
mm-hmm.
That would bring into play where the individual answering the question would have to work it out with reference to what the use of the information that he was getting from various fields.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The application, it was an application type of question.
So that, well, that when you read the answers, for instance, did you expect them mainly to have a good and correct argument, or did you expect them to also give, the evidence sources and so on and so forth for their argument? Or did,
I think it was mostly the to find out how they were thinking.
Mm-hmm. Okay, perhaps to finish up then, our bit of a ramble discussion here is for you to elaborate a bit on your sabbatical trip that you took around the world back in 1957.
All right. That was an eye-opener to me. I enjoyed it tremendously. I had graduate students in the Philippines, in Thailand, India, Greece, Egypt, and Germany. And I just went from one to the other and visited the schools that they were teaching in and visited them teaching. And I had worked out, of course, some kind of questions that I could, so that I had interviews with each of them to see what their state of mind was now that they'd come back. And I discovered, as you would probably know, I would discover, that there was a great deal of discouragement among these students. They had been taught here what would work here.
Mm-hmm.
And then they went back to their own countries all fired up to introduce cumulative records, to introduce a measurement program, to do this, that, and the other thing. And most of it was impossible to do. There was no background among the administrators there to support them in this. So they were many of them were very discouraged. And in the course of talking matters over, they and I agreed that there should be much more personal counseling of students when they come, and warnings about the difference in culture between their country and this country, and the need for them to sort out the kinds of things that would be appropriate for their own countries, could be useful in their own countries, and if they couldn't do it alone, to seek help on making those choices, so that they wouldn't go back with their aspirations far ahead of what they had, what were realistic. Mm-hmm. I think that was what I learned from it.
Do you think that, in other words, that when they came over here initially, that they didn't tell you, well, I don't think this is going to work back in Egypt, or this part of it, the program isn't going to work very well.
I think that I'm sure that we should have had some understanding that it was not going to work. But I think that they were not aware of how, they were young, you know, they're young people. And it's just the same problem that we would have in our own country if we went from one school to another school. It was far less sensitive to the need for guidance, any guidance at all.
Mm-hmm.
And that did not have the staff facilities and the financial ability to support, let's say, a measurement program, and that you can't use a measurement that's good here, and isn't good there. I think that it's the same problem. What I think we did wrong was to assume that they were more mature and were able to see how you could take this big idea and utilize it in somewhat different way back home than we were doing it here. So that's what I came out with. I wrote a rather extensive report, which is on file somewhere, about this. And after that, of course, I wasn't around too long, but in the few years that I was there, I made much more effort, it was a much greater effort on my part, to do the guidance that I thought was appropriate for those students. You see, many of these, we want them to go back and have some contribution to give to their own people. And I think that often they don't go back at all. They decide to stay here. Now, this is what, certainly on the graduate level, you find this all over the universities, university in the various departments. For instance, they'll get an MD here. And they don't even have the machines, the big, the equipment that is needed to put into practice what they have learned here. And so they end up by taking a job out at the University of Illinois or somewhere else, or back in New York State. They're all over the place, you know, Filipinos and people from Taiwan and who have gotten their degrees here, mm-hmm. but they can't go back because there is no way that they can use what they have gained at the university. Now, this we don't want in the School of Education. Mm-hmm. But it does take a great deal, a good many hours of help on the part of a major professor to help them to see how they can use what they're gaining.
At the point when you took your trip, had you been having these students for a number of years, or was this something recent?
Well, not a number of years, mm-hmm. no, because most of them were here for a year or two.
No, but I mean in terms of
I see what you mean. Yes, a few years. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe 8 years or something like mm-hmm. that.
Did these students tend to come on their own, or were they sponsored by the governments, or how is this organized?
Well, both ways. Now, the women from Thailand paid their own way. I think the government paid for them. Mm-hmm. And I think some of them came on scholarships from our government. Mm-hmm. I believe we had two students that I visited in Greece that had some help from our government. And they came in different ways. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that the people from India didn't come on their own. They needed help.
This was the people. Well, then after you came back from this trip, for instance,
yes.
John Guy brought some people over from India? Or was that before?
No, John didn't bring them over. This was he may have brought some people uh-huh. over. But I guess he did. I'm not sure mm-hmm. about that program and how he got them over here. I don't know anything about that okay. program.
But
Verna Carley, who was at that time working in this international area in Washington, mm-hmm. was the one who headed up the group that went to Africa, the women's group who went
right.
To Africa. And that group, I think, consisted of 8 or 9 women. And they were from different areas. I represented guidance and counseling, personnel work, and there was somebody from home economics and various fields of learning, academic fields and so on. And we went over there with the idea of having workshops with secondary and college teachers. Women. Mm-hmm. And in setting this thing up, the first thing we discovered was that the Englishmen, we were going to countries that were parts of the British Empire or still were parts of the British Empire.
I believe you went to Kenya and Nigeria.
We held our workshops there. Mm-hmm. The women came from the whole area. And quite a number of states, you know. But they were held there in those two places. Well, when we first tried to set up this thing, the English person who was head of the Department of Education over there said that there were no women who were capable of coming to a workshop. And he'd send men. And Miss Carley, Dr. Carley,
this
said...
This is one of the Africans who said this.
No, it was the British.
Uh-huh.
The British head of the Department of Education.
Uh-huh.
And we said, well, that was very nice, but we were not interested in having men. We were interested in having having women. So we would not have the project at all unless we had the women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so he scurried around and he found... some perfectly great women, you know, mm. they were there, only he didn't know it. And so we had a workshop in both places, which they were dealing with the problems of secondary school education and teacher education primarily. It was in teacher education,
mm-hmm.
actually. in Kenya and in Sierra Leone and all of those states that are contiguous, one in equatorial Africa in the east and the other in the west. And there we discovered that this was the first experience that these women ever had in dealing with educators from other countries, mm-hmm. from another country. And one of the best things about that trip was that in both East Africa and West Africa, we had a week or 10 days to visit schools and meet teachers in the area, so that we came to the workshops knowing the primitive conditions of the schools. Mm-hmm. And if we hadn't had that, it would have been impossible, for instance, to talk about a cumulative record was silly. And a great many things that we learned in those weeks, of course, gave us our cues of how to deal with the situation. But the finest thing about it was that this was also the first time that they had ever lived under the same roof with whites, mm-hmm. and shared the same bathrooms and ate at the same table. And they were very, very hesitant about all of this. And they expected that when we got into committees, when we got into our meetings, you know, mm-hmm. that we would just stand up there and lecture to them and tell them what they should do and how we did it in this country. And, of course, we did none of that. We started the way you do in a workshop, well, what are your problems? Mm-hmm. And it took a little warm-up, as it always does, even here, you mm-hmm. know. But they entered into this thing, and we had problems that were their problems. We worked in an informal way so that they could give their possible solutions, and we could come in and be as helpful as we could from our viewpoint. And the whole thing worked very, very well. Then the aftermath of this was that they came over here, not all of them, mm-hmm. but a good part of them, supported by the government. And they toured the United States, visited all kinds of schools and colleges. Among them, the school and the church and the whole community where I lived, which is a little tiny community in Vermont. Mm-hmm. And they went from there, you know, to Chicago and all over the country. So they really had a remarkable experience.
When they expressed their surprise that you didn't get up and lecture, mm-hmm. did that in turn, their reaction surprise you? Were you prepared for them to act that way?
Well, we were prepared for them to act that way, yes. Because, you know, almost everybody who's gone over to those foreign countries mm-hmm. have gone over to tell them something. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we were bound and determined we were going to use the workshop method and give them the central role in this thing. And it worked out very well, it really did. And they had a great time and learned far more than a lot of, I think, helpful things that had to do with teacher education and with teachers in the classroom. They learned that we were just like any other human beings, did our washing together, you know, in the same bowls and all that sort of thing. I mean, washing our clothes mm-hmm. and ironing and all of that. It was really quite an eye-opener.
So, in other words, your 58 trip around the world paid off in terms of your interactions with these people.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It really did. Yeah.